Hello, and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. Tom Third loves to push against creative limits and break convention. Known for his modern, hybrid electronic scores, he started out as a hip-hop-loving art school kid who was eventually signed to Network Records, where he produced sample-heavy trip-hop and drum and bass. As a songwriter, he also co-wrote Maren Cadell's cult hit, The Sweater. Transitioning from ads to film and TV, he cut his teeth on the massive hit show Queer as Folk, and is now known for his work on fan favorite shows like The Listener and the breakout hit Coroner. This Gemini winner's working style is creative and experimental, and he loves to color outside the lines. Whether scoring surrealist arthouse cinema or hit TV series, he is happiest when slightly out of his comfort zone. Hey, if you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. Really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. And now, please enjoy this deep dive with the wonderful Tom Third. Tom, such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us today.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
So I want to start out a little different than I normally would. I want to ask you about those very signature architectural glasses that you have on your face that is really the thing that is so visually representative of you. And for anyone who isn't watching this on YouTube, by the way, we do have these on YouTube as well. Can you describe the glasses and why, how did they become your signature?
That's so funny. So these are sort of white wraparound. They were originally sunglasses frames that I got at a place that I've been going to for 30 years here in Toronto that sell all the funky stuff. And I looked at them, they're really kind of crazy, and they look like they're from the 60s kind of thing. Needed new glasses, and I had them pop out the sunglasses frames, and or the sunglass lenses, the tinted lenses, and put my prescription in there. And I've got a really heavy-duty prescription, so they're small enough that I can, you know, wear these without having, crazy Coke bottle bottoms. This is the third pair. I started wearing these in about 2000 or 2004 or something like that. I wore the first pair completely out, and I became so attached to them that I went on eBay and I bought the rest of them, like in the world. Oh, so wow. I just scoured about two pairs from Italy, and one pair came in from Miami. So this is the second pair. I've got one more white pair on the runway downstairs. Amazing. And then I have a black pair. So I may not change out my days. I'll be wearing these glasses until I die.
Oh, man. It's going to be a real shock to the system to see you next time. If you have a different color on your face, I'll be like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, I know. Well, for someone who's I've worn glasses since I was a baby. They knew my whole family's myopic. So yeah. They knew immediately that, like, this kid will not be able to see, of course. And so there's no pictures of me, even as an infant, where I'm not wearing like crazy glasses. It's all very adorable. In retrospect, it was terrifying as a kid. But
I can imagine. Yeah, I had the braces faces, right? So I had the big, the mouth gear with the massive
headgear, right?
Yeah, the whole headgear thing. So having things on your face when you're a kid is not fun.
Yeah,
it's not a really common thing for composers who are so used to being in the background and sort of behind the scenes to sort of stand out visually. Is that something you think about, or is that just like, it seems like you have a lot of fun with visual stuff as well.
I cannot tell a lie. Yeah, that's absolutely always been a concern. I think, when you're awkward and nervous in high school, you try and find ways to, stand out, fit in, be recognized. Mm-hmm. So immediately for me, that was like listening to crazy music and hanging out with all the music people in high school, getting into clothes and being that new wave kid with like the crazy asymmetrical Depeche Mode, haircut. I did all that stuff in high school and never kind of stopped.
Right.
So it's still kind of like a, I like to dress up. There's still that kind of, pop star kind of vibe a little bit that I totally get into.
Right. That's awesome. So how does music and sort of art, is music and art sort of track kind of simultaneously for you? Was that always the case growing up?
Yeah. I mean, it was more art at the beginning. I drew, cars and spaceships, my earliest, memories. I still have those drawings from when I was five of like spaceships and stuff, Star Trek stuff. And I drew, every day of my life. And then ended up going to art college and continuing that. But the music thing was always in there. And you know, I started taking piano lessons when I was, I don't know, probably 9 or 10 or something like that. It was a thing in our family. Like, everybody sort of did a bit of it.
Was it a musical family? Like, was there music in the blood?
Nope. I would say no. I mean, maybe, you know, like my grandmother playing like church hymns on the upright. Not something I really even saw. But I think that was the extent of it. But it's not like, you know, my mom and dad listened to a ton of music. Mm-hmm. You know, I can think of three iconic records that, you know, I heard as a kid. And that was, they just got played infinitely. Mm. But so, yeah, the music and the art thing tracked kind of together. You know, I played in high school bands and did all that stuff, but was still kind of doing the art stuff. And then when you get to art college, you know, those things fuse in a pretty amazing way. In that there's tons of people who are into music and are in bands at the same time they're doing their whatever, their, you know, art college stuff, sculpture and metal work or whatever. And, you know, there's a long legacy of bands that, you know, come from that background, you know, whether it's you know, Blur or the Beatles or whomever.
Talking Heads.
Yeah, exactly.
And do you have like an early sort of memory of when music sort of hit you, or when you had sort of, do you have a memory of like a really profound moment where music really had a big impact on you?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, coming back to my parents' records, you know, everybody in the 60s had the soundtrack to Lawrence of Arabia. Mm. And so my mom would play that, I feel like, every Sunday. You know, that record went on and she would hum to it. And, you know, that amazing, you know, Maurice Jarre, you know, melodic work that's so striking and still influences me to this day. That's a record I play for my students, not because it's that relevant, but because it's, you know, so meaningful to me.
Sure.
There was this oldies program that I listened to as a kid, and the theme music was Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs, that you know, classic organ riff. And that blew up for me. It sounded, you know, we watched Star Trek as a family growing up. Those are my oldest memories of the family sitting around the black and white TV, which means that's before 68. And there's a whole bunch of these 60s soundtracks that were borrowing from the pop music of the day. So they brought organ into it, you know, to sort of mimic these sort of combo organs that you were hearing in The Animals or something like that. And so when I heard the Hammond, and it's not even the Hammond, it's when I heard transistor organs for the first time in the early 70s, that sort of sounded like synthesizers. Like, I didn't know what that sound was, and there's those weird stops. And it's really specific to that transistory distorted Italian film music, kind of Farfisa sound, really stuck with me. And I had a collection of organs here for a long time because of that music. But the kind of that futuristic spy vibe of Green Onions and those Jerry Goldsmith soundtracks, that stuff hit me hard.
And were you ever a John Barry fan? Did you get into like early John Barry?
Absolutely. My dad
was really doing that stuff too, even before, like with the John Barry 5 and even before the James Bond stuff.
Yeah, precisely. So, you know, in the early 70s, you know, the first James Bond movie I saw in a theater was Man with the Golden Gun in 1974. And, but prior to that, you know, ABC Saturday, Sunday night movies or whatever it was, they'd show a James Bond movie, you know, once a year or something like that. It would be a big event, right? Everybody in the neighborhood stayed home so they could watch Thunderball again or You Only Live Twice. And the sound of those, particularly the score for Thunderball, which is one of the sort of most fantastic and evolved ones that John Barry did, I think, where he had all the themes in place and he got that timpani out, and there's great chase music in that one. It's the first CinemaScope one too, which is so great. Yeah, those were gigantically influential. So I really connected with that stuff and how he's all, you know, and there's always that surf twang guitar and stuff that's, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Super, I dig. So yeah, all of that kind of 60s spy music, I still write those chords. I'm still doing that stuff. I've never gotten away from it.
I was checking out an album that you released in 2001 for Network Records called Continuous City. And it's a trip hop. It's basically a trip hop record, more or less, with some drum and bass stuff and lots of loops and crazy textures and really interesting sound design, which really does track with what you're talking about now. It does have that that kind of hallmark kind of 60s spy kind of sound and a lot of that stuff as well.
Yeah. And Yeah, and it was, those were the first records I sampled. Before I, you know, when I started sort of doing album stuff, I didn't know, I had studied music, but I didn't know how to really write or anything like that, or
when,
play.
When about was this? Like, when did you end up working, starting with Network?
I signed with them in 1990. Okay. Or something like that. I was a baby. Mm-hmm. And I had a job colorizing black and white movies. And one of the guys that I worked with, and it was a crazy kind of strange factory of the future populated by a whole bunch of artists because it was a great job. They worked 24 hours around the clock and you could do the night shift while you were going to school. Wow. It was fantastic. And one of the guys I worked with was Sarah McLachlan's bass player.
Okay.
Right. And he knew that I was doing, you know, my crazy synthesizer music and releasing, you know, cassettes and that kind of stuff. Part of that whole cassette culture in the early 80s. And he said, oh, you should talk to the guys at Network, you know, maybe they'd be interested or whatever. So I'd sent Network a cassette. That's so kooky, you know, like it just looked like literally in a mailing envelope.
Oh, sure.
Here's my demo cassette. And they signed me based on that. God love them, Mark Jowett. And that was an amazing experience. But I had no idea what I was doing.
What do you think they saw in that tape that you sent them that appealed to them?
I was doing a ton of, it was all sampled. So with an Akai S612, like super primitive sampling where you only had a few seconds to work with, but enough that you could get two bars of a drum loop at a low sampling frequency. And it just sounded dope at the time, right? And this is just, you know... Sorry, what year? No, so 1990, right? You know, like De La Soul, all, you know, Art of Noise, all of these things were kind of out there where people were using the Fairlight and then the S900 and all that stuff. So I think I was, and because of the kinds of records I was sampling, which was all these old Spaghetti Western records and John Barry stuff and, you know, all the records that I grew up with, like a lot of people do, but they weren't soul records. My parents didn't listen to that. They listened to Nana Mouskouri and the Kingston Trio and Xavier Cugat. And so that's all the stuff that I got that got sampled onto those first records. So it had more of a kind of a, you know, a Beck vibe or something like that. And I was sampling like widely from all kinds of stuff, wherever I could find loops. And I didn't know about, you know, I was just finding out about R&B at that time, you know, hearing it kind of for the first time, like, oh, there's the funky drummer loop. And then that's a Lynn Collins song. And so I was just starting to bring that material in because I was really into hip hop. So I think it was that. And they were looking to diversify. At the time, Sarah McLachlan was kind of a huge, you know, light on their label. But at the same time, they had started with this tradition of electronic music, Skinny Puppy and Mauve and Single Gun Theory. And they wanted to diversify and have more electronic stuff. And I kind of fit that bill, you know?
That's really cool. And so, you know, 1990, you get signed with Elektra. That's just after you graduate from OCAD, the Ontario College of Art and Design. And I'm assuming that you were working on your music while you were working on, you know, all the visual art stuff. The one thing I want to know is, like, I think your first sort of foray into music for picture is through commercials, right? You were doing work for ads.
Yeah.
Did that come up around the same time?
It did.
How did that come out?
They were exactly related in that I put out my first record that was Brothers and Systems. That was kind of like a hip hop, straight up hip hop, you know, 90s hip hop. You know, I was listening to De La Soul and I was doing that kind of like hilariously kind of, you know, cheeky sampling. And after that record came out, my day job at that time was as a production assistant on videos with a company here in Toronto called Revolver. And so I would go out and rock videos and I would be the guy like schlepping camera gear out into the swamp to shoot some band or something. It was a great gig. You know, I drove the cube van. It was a great gig. It was hilarious. And you meet a lot of people. And so I had this record out and Revolver was also working on, you know, moving into commercials out of out of the rock video world because there's no money to be made doing videos. Mm. They're just basically calling cards, still the same to this day. So everybody makes their money doing commercials. And then, you know, stuff came up because I had a bit of street cred from having, and I was on Electric Circus because I was doing this dance music stuff. I had a bit of street cred associated with that first album. And a gig came up with my first sort of commercial gig was with Floria Sigismondi, who a lot of people will know is a pretty famous video director now, who's worked with David Bowie and Nine Inch Nails and slew of, you know, sort of amazing sort of top tier bands. And we did an industrial video together for the Jog Bra company. So this is like a jogging bra back when those things were just sort of being invented. And that sort of led to just doing a whole bunch of commercial work. And coming off of that first record with Network, you know, you do a record and you think, oh, my life's changed. I'm going to be raking in the cash now.
Right.
And then you realize that's not what happens. You got to make rent. And so so I started doing commercials, which I loved. And I miss it a little.
How did you sort of navigate the... First of all, the creative difference that would be between making your own record, probably fairly on your own terms, and really, you know, chasing your own muse, to something where it's, you know, you've working with a collaborator, a director of a commercial, and maybe even a client who wants specific things.
Yeah.
What was that sort of like?
I loved it. I thought it was really fun and exciting. Like, as opposed to, I've never sort of entered into these, I think because it was just icing on the cake. I was happy to be working and making money doing music. It was just like, I thought I'd sort of won the lottery. And back in the days working on commercials, it was like that. It paid incredibly well.
Right.
Those days are long gone. But back in the beginning, it was really sort of lucrative. And I was just kind of working for myself. And I bought one of the first sort of Pro Tools systems in the city and was suddenly doing jobs that were normally being, you know, farmed out to big recording studios when we still had those in the city, you know, big 24 track, you know, tape. So I had my crazy little digital system. So working with clients, I just found it fascinating and interesting. They'd ask for stuff. They'd go, okay, we need a country and Western track. I'm like, what do I'm like a Kraftwerk person. Like, I don't know anything about country and Western songs. So I have to listen to some, you know, old Buck Owens songs to see what that's about and write music like that. I found it totally hilarious. and as a corporate culture to work in, it's really sophisticated.
Right.
It is like Mad Men in that, you know, there's protocols and there's traditions. That have evolved in a kind of a time honored way. And when I was doing this stuff in the early 90s, I was working with the Don Drapers, who, you know, if I had, you know, an exec in their 60s or something, they were the madmen. They had worked in the 60s and 70s. I worked with a bunch of those people, and they were great and had stories.
Oh my God. And do you, I mean, I sort of missed the boat on when things were really slushy in terms of these kinds of like recording sessions and everything, where they have sushi plates and
yes,
you know,
exactly.
Booze and drinks and, you know, other illicit substances in some cases.
Yep.
Like, that must have been pretty crazy at some times.
For a 25-year-old suddenly doing whatever, you know, a car commercial or something like that. And I mean, I felt so glamorous.
Wow.
It felt so glamorous to me. Yeah, exactly, with the sushi plates. And you're like, wow, okay, are we allowed to steal that and take it home? I was used to going to gallery openings and like taking food home because I was broke.
What about this, like, did you ever return to those sampling routes while you were in there? And did it ever cause you problems because you were lifting things from records that had copyrights associated with them, or did they kind of just slip under the radar?
I'm smiling because the amount of illegal things I did back in the day is radical. I'm surprised. Right. I haven't been really called out. I mean, one of the first things I did a song with a performance artist, Maren Cadell, called The Sweater. Right back before I started, I had my deal with Network, but we hadn't put the record out yet. And that song's, there's some mad sampling in there that is not cool. Okay. And we've never, and the song, you know, went into Rolling Stone magazine, was on the top 100 singles.
It was a big hit.
Yeah, it was a thing. And no one said anything about it. And then in the commercials, because I, you know, being a synthesizer guy, I didn't know how to play anything. I didn't know how to, like, I didn't know any musicians really. Right. So anytime I got one of these gigs, it's like, well, how can I build up this commercial soundtrack just with samples? So I was sampling, you know, Quincy Jones and whatever, the same things I was sampling on in my hip hop tracks. They all went out on air. And I think it was because it was at the beginning of that.
Right.
I think even the early lawsuits, you know, with De La Soul and Vanilla Ice and stuff, I think they had just happened or were just happening around that time. People weren't quite wise to it. And there weren't, you know, there was no internet.
Right.
So stuff didn't live on the internet to be scanned. So
yeah.
These things are long gone. Anyway, right. I sampled like mad.
Huh.
Partly because I loved the sound of it. I mean, for me, it's a sound. It's a multifold sound where you're bringing in notes and melody, but you're mostly bringing in context,
right?
And you're bringing cultural context. You know, for me, it was like I wanted to bring in things that were meaningful to me as a kid that has had resonance. These old James Bond soundtracks or whatever, and then also they have a textural component to them,
right.
Which is how old recordings sounded. They're in mono. They're from vinyl. They're compressed in terms of bandwidth.
Yes.
And putting, you know, I made collages in high school. It was the same kind of thing where I'd be, you know, I'd have a high resolution photograph on top of a low resolution photograph. And I was really interested in that juxtaposition. It creates a kind of an illusion of depth because you have things with sort of compressed bandwidth and then things with sort of broadband coexisting in the same space. And somehow that one of those gets thrown to the back, you know? I've always been fascinated by that with sampling, and I still do it in my mixes now. Like, mm-hmm. How can I constrain the bandwidth of this thing so that that thing, you know, exists in a different part of space or exists in a wider space or something? So I work with mono and stereo stuff all the time when I'm mixing. I sampled a lot. And then it was also a way of, you know, learning how to write music when I didn't feel comfortable writing.
Okay.
I think I've spent my whole career getting away from sampling. Like, I don't do it anymore. On stuff I'm doing, I just write it and have people play it. And it's a different experience. But I needed that stepping stone.
Right. It became an education of sorts.
Yeah. I had to, like, okay, I can't sample everything.
Yeah.
And it was also like the frustration of sampling before we could time stretch and pitch correct and all those kinds of things. You'd bring in a sample, you'd play it at the tempo you wanted, and then the pitch was all crazy, it didn't fit. So you just kind of went with it. And that was kind of, you hear that in old hip hop.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many times when I've, like, been listening to a track, like, I remember this one time at a House of Lords, that crazy haircutting place on Yonge Street. And they were playing all sorts of, like, house records. And there were so many tracks where I'm like, that sample is not even remotely in the key of the lead vocal. Like, it's completely out to the point where it's, like, quite dissonant, but they're just like, the texture is obviously the most important part.
That was one of the things about hip hop that freaked me out. And I also found super compelling because think the origins of that sound are simply like a technical deficit. You know, they couldn't change the pitch of something like we can now.
Right.
And so they just put it in and they went, that sounds dope. And to me, as a listener back in the day, I thought, that sounds crazy and wrong to me, but maybe it's right. Do you know what I mean? Like, no, I got used to that sound.
There's an interesting tie into some of the other stuff I want to talk about later, but I think it's so interesting to consider it from a point of view of, like, you know, we're so used to in the way that, you know, with the amount of content and, you know, productions that are put out there and the amount of music that people are writing for it, it does have the tendency to become a copy of a copy of a copy. And it's really trending towards, well, this has to be pleasing. It has to please everyone. And it has to be sort of like, you know, don't do anything that's kind of outside. Yeah, or if it's outside, it's just a little bit. And then, oh, okay, we expanded the boundary a little bit. But something like that, where you're just like smashing two things together and just putting it out there and going, no, this is it. Like, understand this from the thing that it is, as opposed to the other things that you're trying to point to that you're contextualizing in space. I think that's super interesting. And to me, I find that really inspiring to sort of, you know, have this conversation and think about my own work and go, whoa, what's the way that I can kind of, like, do that a bit more and maybe push on the boundaries, because we're always looking for a new way to say something that's been said before, or to say something in a different way.
Absolutely. And I think of all the time, like, I mean, one of the things about, you know, getting a little bit of training musically is that it sort of prevents you from making some of these errors.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, well, I can't have the thing out of pitch. I got a pitch corrector. I got to do this thing to fix it, to make it right, to, you know, be in the key, be in tempo or whatever. And then I'll listen to pop music and I'm like, they don't give a shit about that. It's not even on their radar. And they just do a thing. And I go, God, that sounds fantastic. You know, I remember when, you know, bands like Burial or something like that started having these weird, you know, loping, skipping, out of time beats.
Yes.
You know, they're kind of like, that's not on the grid. That's like some weird loosey-goosey thing. And I would never let myself do that before. Just play something in and not quantize it.
Right.
And not, and but not about feel, just like about weird. And now when I hear that stuff in contemporary hip hop and R&B, I'm like, that is just sounds so cool. It's got a tension to it. It's got a weird role. So I've acclimatized to these new forms of making music that I think come out of people just like who are, you know, not afraid to just kind of go outside the box.
Mm-hmm. So I want to jump forward into your past the commercials. When did Queer as Folk come into your life, and what was the story behind how that came together?
Queer as Folk kind of happened out of the blue. I got a phone call. And I didn't have an agent at that time. And it was one of those things. I had a bit of a reputation. You know, I had done enough things. I heard later on, and I think from my hairdresser, that the producer on Queer as Folk's hairdresser was not my hairdresser, mentioned my name to her. And that was what started the ball rolling. Now, I've never confirmed that, but it sounds as true as anything.
And how did this hairdresser know of your music?
Because hairdressers like know hip hop or whatever, and someone knew my records or something. And you know, also working in the rock video world, like I knew a lot of hair and makeup people because you know there was old people around. You know, so friends of mine were doing that kind of stuff. It's probably true, and I will ask Sheila one of these days. Is that true? Is that what happened? So that show landed in my lap, and it was sort of like my record deal in that it was a bit of a bolt out of the blue. You know, I was trying to get jobs like that, but I didn't. Landing a TV series was like a big deal. I mean, it's still a big deal. You know, I still fight for every one of them. You know, you can never rest. And they really took a chance with me because I didn't know what I thought, because I'd done a feature film and a bunch of commercials and some records, that I was well equipped to do long form drama. I was not, you know, there are commonalities, but it's kind of a different animal. And so I just worked on that for the sort of the first season and not the entire first season. It turned out the show became really popular and their budget went up and they ended up using all source music because it was really about, you know, sort of the gay scene. I can't remember what city it was set in the United States, but so there was tons of club stuff, and I was writing some of that in the first season because I had that background. I was really into house, but they ended up going with a full sort of source music score for the subsequent seasons. I learned. It was a tremendous experience for me, tremendous, and it took a long time to get another series after that, but it gave me a taste of how ill-equipped I was to do TV and what, you know, things that needed to change. I needed to, like, I got to up my game. The schedule here is faster than I'm used to. And I thought I was fast coming from commercials where you could turn stuff around in a few days or something like that. But they're just 30-second things. Yeah. So, yeah, you can turn those around in 3 hours. And the other big, big difference is that the ideas that are sustainable over 30 seconds or 60 seconds or even in short films are not the same ideas that can fly in drama, in that you only have to really have kind of one motive kind of in a 30-second thing. And we see that in car commercials now. It's just a groovy loop. And in some sense, it, to me, it's that the flame that burns twice as brightly burns half as long, because they can kind of have a singleness of purpose to them. It can be super thrilling sounding, but it's like, that's not going to last any more than 30 seconds. We're going to get bored. So it was a matter of sort of figuring out how to make that skill, you know, the music sound design thing, vibe skill, and translate that into drama. And that's what I've been working on ever since, without a shred of boredom, because it's so fascinating to write drama stuff.
As I started getting into writing more for the screen, I found one of the challenges to be thinking less in terms of vertical structures and more in terms of horizontal structures.
Yeah.
So things that evolve over time, and melodies and chord progressions and where this is going in a bigger arc, a much bigger arc than a 3-minute song that has a lot of repeating sections, because the song is about an idea that's encapsulated and sort of self-contained. Whereas no, this scene is moving and changing, and these people are like coming in and out. What are some of the things that you hook onto when you, let's say, for instance, you get a scene for the first time and you're going to have a meeting with the director or the showrunner to talk about it? What are some of the things you hook onto typically?
For me, it's all kind of, yeah, the structure now is horizontal instead of vertical. Absolutely for me. And to me, there's kind of a geometry to it. I think of all melody in terms of sort of geometry and proportion for the most part. When I look at a scene, and I think, you know, I had a really cool sound teacher at OCAD, John Tucker. And if I'm not mistaken, he put this idea in my head, and I think I've elaborated it since or something. But if I want to, you know, spot a scene, or like, I don't want to put this scene together, I look at the scene, I write down what happens in the scene. There's three things, whatever. This happened, and this happened, and this happened, and it leads to the next scene if it's kind of well written. And, you know, I can just mark those things in the timeline. And on my vertical axis, it's like, well, how much energy does that moment have? And so I end up with this, you know, horizontal line that it represents time, and these vertical lines that represent the story beats that are, you know, varying heights. And maybe at the end of the scene, it's the climax, and that's the highest one. And then I think of the music literally as a tarp, or a circus tent that just descends from above, drops onto these tent poles, and what happens? Then you have this kind of like suspension bridge kind of structure, and that the cue is written, as far as I'm concerned, once I do that. Because then that also visually describes the notions of tension and release. You know, so you've got a tension building up to this first story beat, tent pole. We have a release after that. And then we're building up to this next one, and then we've got a release, and then we've got a thing, and out. So the notion of tension and release is, I think, the single, you know, that's the Rosetta Stone, or the ne plus ultra of film scoring, is just figuring out where those moments of release are, and writing your music so that you release at that moment, and you build up beforehand, and then it's just filling in the blanks, I find. And, you know, I remember one of my first series that I worked on after Queer as Folk was called Regenesis. Really, really cool show, way ahead of its time. And I was doing, in the first season or two, I was sort of doing all the kind of electronic-y stuff. And they brought Rob Carley in, who was a much more experienced composer, to do some of the more sort of, you know, touchy-feely stuff that I didn't have as good a handle on. And watching Rob score stuff blew my mind. It's like, oh, this guy's got it figured out. He knows exactly how to score that scene. And one thing I noticed from like studying his scenes, right? I was resentful, and I was also ecstatic that I had this opportunity to look at how he did stuff. And Rob is like, you know, there's a chord change on this moment, there's a chord change on that moment, and there's a chord change on that moment, and then figure out the stuff in between. And when I look now at, you know, a lot of the work he's done, it's like, oh yeah, he's like that. He's just got it nailed. And so now I do what Rob does. And that relates, you know, this thing I learned from, you know, my OCAD instructor about this kind of, you know, vertical, you know, tent pole structures and heat maps and all that kind of stuff. It depends who I'm talking to. But if I'm talking to the writers, then I'll talk exactly the way I'm talking to you know, you and the audience here. It's like, let's figure out what these story beats are, and tension and release, in the same way they would think about writing the narrative. You know, we're not, we're going to have a little bit of a, you know, foreshadowing here, but we don't want to overdo it so that when we pay off here at the end of the Agatha Christie thing or something, it feels mm-hmm. great. And especially, you know, when there's been a hint of the motif earlier and then you pay off at the end with that thing and the audience goes, oh, I'm in somebody's hands here. They like, they paid off something at the end that reminds me of something that they offered up earlier on as a bit of an Easter egg. And you see that in written narrative, of course, all the time. There's a gun on the mantelpiece. I think about music in that same kind of way. So it's structure, 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 structure.
God,
structure.
Yeah,
how to tell that's that amazing. Story. Structure, 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 yeah. structure. And I talk about it in acts, and I talk about it in dramatic terms. And I act it out and I hum it for people. And you know, like in a meet, I'll go like, bum, 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 bum. We got that thing, chase scene, but we're going to go boom. And so it's just like broadcast news where I'm kind of like, you know, acting right. it out for people to
oh,
just like,
great.
It's going to be like that. It's going to sound amazing. And I don't know what the instruments are yet. Let me have a look. You know, I don't know
that
what it's, I have
so
no
cool.
idea what this is about or how, you know, the sound, you know, we talk a lot about what we don't want. Mm-hmm. Like no cellos here, no saxophones.
This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, celebrating its 40th year in 2020. The SCGC is a national association of professional music composers and producers for film, television, and media, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights for film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. And now back to our show. When you're developing the sound for a show or for a film, are you a very conceptual person or are you more running on instinct and trying things out and running experiments?
Experiments. I talk about it conceptually, mostly from a character sense.
Right.
And then when I get down and dirty and actually start thinking about what the, you know, palette is and the sounds are, I just throw convention. The concept, I'm absolutely willing to go off, you know, book and do something that's not part of that original mandate.
Right.
So I don't wed myself to it because it's partly because I think that kind of art making where you write an algorithm and then follow the algorithm is boring. Once the audience knows what the algorithm is,
right.
There's no surprises left. And when I look at literature that I find really interesting or films that I find really interesting, it's when they do break, when they set up an expectation from the audience of like, this is what we think, this is the algorithm that we're using, this is the concept. And then they, you know, in the third act, they do something where they yank that concept away from you.
Mm.
And you're, you know, in an exciting way, if that will, that forces you, it can be a thing that doesn't spoil the work, but allows you to sort of see the work kind of from a meta viewpoint,
right?
You see the structure of the work while you're watching the work, kind of a French film kind of a way. So I like to bring in instruments, you know, once, you know, at the end, like for the first time, like, oh, where did that come from? What's that doing in there? It has nothing mm-hmm. to do with the rest of the score. So I try and, I guess it's kind of an anarchist sensibility. Like I try and blow it up
yeah.
in every score. Like, how can I blow this up in a way that doesn't subvert the artwork in a self-serving or kind of a cheeky kind of a way. It's a fine
right.
line.
Yeah. So that sort of that idea of throwing convention out or bending the rules, blurring the lines between what is expected and not, I'd like to sort of talk a little bit about your relationship with a filmmaker named Philip Barker. You sent me a short experimental film yesterday called Malady, which I highly, highly recommend people check out. You can find it on Vimeo and on YouTube as well. It's Malody, and the filmmaker is Philip Barker. It is just a stunning piece, both visually and orally. And I'd like to talk about it from the perspective of how you then moved into shows like The Listener and Coroner, where you're treading a different line.
Yeah. So Philip Barker is super talented experimental filmmaker. And we've known each other now since the early or mid 80s or something. I met him while I was in art school, I believe. And he was doing, you know, really gigantic sort of public projection kind of pieces. So his work, you know, in the tradition of experimental film, you know, it's nonlinear. There's not a lot of dialogue in them at all, typically. And they're sort of designed as sort of sound pieces in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And initially with his films, Malady is the last one, actually, I would do everything to do with the sound. So I would write whatever music needed to be written, but then I would also do the whole sound edit. Mm-hmm. And that was an amazing sort of learning experience for me as well, to just get on the other side of that equation and figure out just how much work that actually is. It's mind-boggling. And I only do it with select projects now because it takes a lot of time. But the really amazing thing about those films was that I could control the or design or oversee the whole sound experience in terms of how sound effects and music and dialogue all played together, and make more radical choices than a conventional film would make. So we played in all of them with warping out the production sound and taking dialogue out and putting dialogue in the wrong spot and moving dialogue out of sync, having the sound effects take over the music in crazy ways. We did all kinds of weird stuff in surround. Super interesting things to work on. When I started to move into sort of television work, you know, Listener and Regenesis and, you know, now Coroner, I still think, like, well, how can I get some of these crazy deconstructed narrative ideas into these shows? Like, what can we get away with? And the joy of having worked on all these shows, I've been extraordinarily lucky in terms of the production companies I've been involved with. I've done a lot of work with Shaftesbury Films, and that was The Listener and Regenesis and the Atwood Stories. And they're just, you know, those sort of dream collaborators where they really want you to experiment and you know, try and innovate, you know, in a media sphere where there's just a lot of sameness. It's like, well, how can we blow this up? And I'm very interested in blowing it up and subverting and making fun of and elevating. Like, how do we turn this artwork around? In some sense, we've been at it for a while, and maybe we're all a bit bored, you know? Oh. So we're like, okay, let's blow it up. So they're trying to blow it up with the writing. They're encouraging me to kind of blow it up. And I'm like, and they've seen some of those Philip Barker films, I think, and they know my sort of pop music background. It's also, they're a bit crazier than I am. It's one of the joys of working with them. In some sense, you work in television and certainly working on ads, you get used to, you know, pleasing your client. What I find with these last couple of collaborations is if I'm being too conservative and just doing something that solved the problem. We got a love scene. There's some love scene music in there. Especially with Adrian Mitchell, you know, it's just like, Tom, it's like, I know you can do, we know who you are. We know you can go crazier with this. Give it another go. Right. We got time. And even if it's, you know, the day before the mix now, I will say, I still got an idea. So you know what? We're going to have the safety version in the mix, and we're going to have my messed up idea in the mix too, just in case. And we'll be able to look, you know, and see, you know, if the crazier version flies. It always flies, which is such a delight.
That's amazing.
They're a bit fearless in that sense. They're more fearless than me. And the CBC has also been, you know, a terrific partner in all of this, where there's stuff I'll do and I'll think, there's no way that's getting through. There's no way that is ever going to get on air. And the CBC will go, we love it. The theme music for Coroner was done, you know, a modular synth. It's just the nastiest sounding square wave nonsense ever. Anyway, that was not my plan to make that the theme music. It was something. And I think, right, Adrian Mitchell said, let's take that weird thing and let's make that the theme music for Coroner. I'm like, yeah, sure, great.
What is, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about, I definitely have my own creative partners where I feel like I can push the envelope. And the question always becomes, why are we doing this? And what is the ultimate boundary? Like, if we say there are no rules, then you never stop making things and it just sort of becomes chaos. What do you find the guiding principle behind working in that way? So you know if you've gone, I don't want to say too far, but you know where things start to lose meaning. Like, it's very interesting what you said about the theme, where you're taking something that wasn't designed. So there was no concept to say, well, here's what we want to say. and then designing something that really pushes against that. It's you found something and they went, let's try this for this. How do you know if you're smoking too much of your own crack?
Well, on television, you are informed you're smoking too much crack. And so
especially in Toronto, they have a bad history of that.
Absolutely. There's a team of voices that say that's not working.
Right.
And I'm always going to push up against that. I mean, I talk a lot about the non-linearity, like where you've got the gyroscope on the tight wire or something. It's spinning. It's all fine, or the top or whatever. And then it just, it starts to oscillate and wobble, sure. And then boom, it's gone. So that moment before the gyroscope flies off the tightrope, that moment of transition from linearity to non-linearity is where I think all art should live. So how close can we get?
Have you ever found yourself advocating for a piece that you did that really pushed it and they were like, I don't know. And you're like, no, we have to go this far for it.
Yep. Definitely.
How did that conversation go? How do you couch those kinds of,
I actually got on my knees.
Oh no.
And begged a producer in the mix. It was a bit theatrical, but I think I got down on one knee, but what did I do? It was Christina Jennings, who's one of the most amazing and talented and sophisticated producers, and recognizes risk. In retrospect, I don't know if it was a cue that was really that worth fighting for, but I thought it sounded like Radiohead or something. I thought it was neat. And she said, I don't know about this one. And I said, trust me, this is great. Mm. Just trust me on this one. I think everybody's had those moments. I don't battle on every cue.
For sure.
But that was one hill I wanted to die on. And I just wanted to make it known, like, I believe in this one. I think it's cool, and these are the reasons. That aren't sort of about my ego. It was sort of about, well, it must be in some level, but, it was about, I think this is progressive. And I think your audience will feel the story. You'll feel kinship with the characters in the story if we go to this place,
right?
It'll tweak the audience in a different way. Those are always things to do, kind of with tone and texture. But so yeah, a few times, I really put in my first draft that I show people, I go for it, pretty typically. Like I'll just, this is the time to put the crazy ideas out on the table, or we're still 4 or 5 days out from the mix. Just put the crazy gestures out there. And, or another way of thinking about this, the spinning top is for me, it's just like, let's figure out where the boundary is by crossing it and then walk it back. Because for me, if I have a regret coming out of a mix or with any kind of artwork I do, it's like, oh, I didn't go far enough. I didn't figure out what the boundary condition was to know when to drop back. Like maybe I could have gone crazier. And I think we all feel that is like you think you're being innovative or you think you've got something happening, and then you see someone else's show and you go, oh my God, I'm so lame here. Why didn't I push it as far as Chernobyl? Or The Sopranos, or anything you watch, you go, oh my God, the music's amazing in that, or the writing's amazing in that. So I try personally, when I was doing my records, they always took me a long time to do. I'm working on a song, and then I would listen to my song, and I would go, it's worse than the previous version.
Mm.
That's how long I've been working on it. I actually reached the peak of the mountain 2 weeks ago. That's the version. But I would not have known I reached the peak of the mountain unless I'd crossed over into the other side of the Valley of Despair or whatever. So same with this TV stuff. It's like, why don't I just push right to the summit, like straight away, and and they call me on it. This is no crazy. What are you thinking? Nuts. The most loving way. Adrian's not like that, but the notes are, that's not, I'm not feeling that.
Right.
And the notes are great. And here's what's, for me, what's why I love television so deeply to work on it, is you're working quite quickly. And so you don't have a lot of time to second guess or to really, massage your authorship into a thing. You kind of got to like just dive in. And a lot of times you'll be working so quickly and you realize you've gone down sort of one path and you've got a lot of inertia and this is how this cue is going to sound. And you kind of realize while you're halfway down that hill, I should have taken a left and gone down that hill, but I don't have time to get there. Yeah. So I'm just going to kind of go where I'm going. And what it forces you to do is very quickly like conceptualize and execute and then enter into a kind of a free form. The inability to second guess, I think, puts you in a creative place where you are forced to dig deep and act very intuitively and ignore your own self-censorship.
All right. So what you're describing is, I think there's two routes that people take. Some people are completely paralyzed by this intersection.
Yeah.
And you've obviously figured out a way to cultivate what I would call flow states, where you're just in a creative zone, you're able to develop and execute on ideas and somehow keep at bay that nagging editorial voice that's saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
What are your methods for that? Like, what do you do to get into those states? How do you maintain them? Are there steps you take? Is there habits that you have?
It's born out of necessity. Mm-hmm. I feel so. Because when I work on my own stuff occasionally, like I get back into sort of second guessy, self editorializing, all that kind of stuff, because I have the luxury to analyze more, with the thought that maybe if I think about this more, the writing will be better. So the TV deadlines help squash any of that. Part of it is just a disposition thing. And some of that comes out of some of the experiences, like it won't be the end of the world. If you don't get there, it's not perfect. Everybody in television is working fast and they all recognize that, not everything is going to be 100%. Not every cue is going to fly. And every once in a while, in the mix, they just take it out. Like, Tom, it's not working. You never got there. No big deal. It's not said like that. But, we think the thing is stronger without the music or whatever. Or we're taking out these stems. All that kind of stuff happens. And you kind of know. It's like, I didn't quite get there with that one because I only had 2 hours to figure it out. It used to scare me more. And I find it scares me less now. I used to be a bit more anxious about meeting the deadlines or can I do this within this amount of time? And now I kind of sort of think, I'm just going to do it in this amount of time. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be fine.
I wonder if it has, something else you said that I can't remember if I read this or you said this directly to me, but the quote is, great things happen when you're out of your comfort zone. The work you're afraid to present is often your best work. If you're learning that lesson over and over again, then I guess when you get into that, if you get into those states and this is familiar now, maybe that helps get that sort of inertia going and you're rolling down a hill as opposed to pushing.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember going back to my art college days, the work that I thought was the least ready to show or felt like the most precious and made me the most vulnerable because it came from the heart. Showing that work initially was terrifying because you might get a critique where your prof would go, that's garbage. And when they say that's garbage, they're talking about you. Your garbage, because that work came from your heart, right? It's like, that's my baby. What are you talking about? So that could be really devastating. I think that was kind of good training in a sense. I don't know if I recommend it, and I try not to do it when I teach now, but that vulnerability, I think the work that comes from the most, it's also about these boundary conditions. I think when the work is the most dangerous in terms of what you're revealing about yourself, that's the kind of work I want to consume as a consumer of art. I want to see read the twisted poetry of so-and-so and watch, confessional, filmmaking. So I find it interesting when other artists do it. So I think it's incumbent on me to go there myself. And once you've, I guess like bungee jumping or something, which I've never done. But once you've done it a few times and realize you're not going to die, you just feel more comfortable. And if you're working with creative partners who recognize the risks that you're taking creatively and are forgiving and encouraging, then you feel suddenly empowered. And that's certainly how it is for me on Corner, where like, not everything I do is going to hit the mark, but they know that if they don't encourage me to go into those really personal, crazy places, they're not going to get my best work.
Wow.
I know actors do that with directors. I know when I'm working with musicians and they come in, you know, someone will play a take, right? And I'm like, oh God, that is so bad. That is so wrong. That is not going to happen. It's not working, right? But what do you say to them as a director and as a partner? It's like, great. This is it. We're getting there. Let's like dig deeper. Let's work with this, right? And you get them feeling motivated and comfortable to dig it, find in. Anyway, 100% of the time, that approach works for me. Like, it's like, wow, we got to a place, you know, as a partnership in terms of, you know, someone coming in and playing something for me. And it's like, I got an idea in my head how I want it to sound. And then they'll do something different. And then we meet somewhere. I think, oh, actually, their take on it is, I got to recalibrate my own expectations as a member of a team. It's like, actually, their idea is a good one, you know, and I got to fix that. And then I've got some ideas. Anyway, you get to a place. So that encouragement from outside is a huge part where you feel like you're family and that no matter what you do, they will still love you.
That is, I mean, that's just a beautiful creative partnership. And I think that it's really nice to see that you're consciously bringing that into your own work when you're hiring other people and trying to create that culture in the work that you're doing. Do you think there's a way that people can cultivate and be more conscious and have agency about how the kinds of creative collaborations and partnerships they set up and how they're moving through their own creative work? Because, I mean, one of the things I hear a lot from, you know, I don't even think it's creators. I think it's people from all walks of life, is that they seem to accept the relationships that they get into as just sort of, this is how it is. We have no control over these things. My opinion is we have an incredible amount of control. In fact, it's almost always up to us. Do you have a thought process or ideas about how you formulate that or take ownership of those kinds of things?
That's a good question. I feel as though I've been extraordinarily lucky mm-hmm. with all the relationships I've had. Like, it's like everybody's great. Excuse me. And then I think, well, is everybody great? Or is there something about my disposition that is making it seem as though everything's great? When maybe I see hints of this in other people's relationships with their producers sometimes, is that they don't have as good a relationship as I do. Or something, or they found it a rougher road, or they didn't, you know, respond as well to the notes or something. And I think actually some of it's on them, in that the way they responded to the adversity was could have been. It basically takes, I believe, just a lot of patience, and a lot of just like, hang on, it's not everything's about this moment. Like if I just like look a week in the future. When the show's out the door and we've gotten, or the film's done or all of that stuff. It's like a lot of this, what seems like conflict isn't actually, it's just not that bad. And I noticed when I used to do commercials, we would, and maybe that's where some of this experience came from. I was doing these commercials all the time and we would fret, you know, maniacally over every frame, right? And every gesture. And it was as though it was a science and that we were tapping into the cortices of the audience. And if we just do this one thing, they're going to buy that car. And, you know, we just got to change that one thing, move that word here. You know, I started to sitting in those sessions, I thought, this is kind of a bit preposterous. It's part of what's justifying these huge sums flying around. And it's as though we, you know, understand the human psyche. And then a week later, or even an hour later, I would look at the commercial on air. I go, what was that thing we were arguing about? So I've often, well, I still think this, like some of the decisions where you're really agonizing over it, the reason they're hard to decide is not because they're important. It's because it's a flip of the coin, like just flip the coin. Mm. This note here, this thing here, that, just flip a coin. The reason it's so hard is because you don't have enough, because the choice isn't obvious. Mm. When the choice is obvious, you go, yeah, take that music cue out. Yeah, cut that scene. The actor didn't do that right or whatever. Those are obvious and make those choices. But this super microscopic stuff, I don't know if it's relevant in the end, because I don't even hear it when I look at, you know, stuff that I've done a few years ago or something. It's like, I know we struggled over that cue. Sounds fine to me now.
Right.
You know, or I hated it when I did it. I thought it was junk. And then someone will put it in a temp track later on. I'll go, who did that? And they go, well, that's you. That's stuff you sent us. And I'm like, oh, sounds good. That's I like mean. It now. Yeah. So it's just a disposition thing. I think it's just like, stop for a moment and just think a week in the future about what is this decision really yielding for us? And, you know, should we move on? So when I get notes from people, I do them. For all of us, you know, you come in as artisans, we're just there to sort of serve the narrative. So I think of music like cinematography and production design and costume design. They're all just as important. They all tonally sort of set the mood. You know, the costume design does as much for me as the music does in a lot of films. Mm-hmm. And if the costume design is bad or off, or, you know, this period stuff, and it's like, you know, some 60s film where they're, you know, overbaking the costume design, that kills it for me in the same way a bad score would. Or the cinematography, it's overlit or something. You know, I see stuff all the time aesthetically. I go, it's not working. It looks like TV to me.
I love that. I mean, I'd really want to sort of pause on that idea that it's a disposition thing. You're taking a step back, look a week into the future, ask yourself, how important is this one decision? Step back from your own ego and how important you think the work you're doing is in the context of what you just said. All these other departments putting in their heart and soul. And the one thing I would say, when you talk about disposition, it makes it seem like, well, it's either you have it or you don't.
I think
that can be cultivated. I think you can decide to, you know, look at it from a bigger picture and not go down the road of going, my music is being thrown at, or I'm not being given, afforded the right amount of respect or whatever. That's.
Yeah. And disposition. Yeah. Cause that's not really an actionable thing, mm-hmm. right? For people watching, it's like, if I just change my disposition, who I am, my genetic makeup, then I'll be good at this. Yeah. And I agree with you 100%. It can be cultivated and it comes from sort of experience too.
Yeah.
Like I know I fought over a decision like this before. I tried to save that piece of music, or they took something out and I felt stung by it. And then I realized later that I didn't feel as stung or disrespected as I did initially. Right. I still think of it as such a privilege that it's half the time I don't care what they do with the music. I'm just kind of happy to be in this business and be associated with these people. So, you know, disrespect, never in my, 20, plus years of doing this have I ever felt disrespected. Now I can think of one, but
we won't go there.
Yeah. And one out of a billion times, it's like people, particularly everyone's a creative. That's the thing.
Sure.
You're working with writers and they're all, that's why I have such a kinship with them. They feel just as possessive and precious about their creations. They're also afraid,
right.
I've got a script. Will you look at it, maybe? It's exactly how I feel with my music. I've got a music cue. Don't hit me. And then you read it, you go, that's a great script. I love it. You took some real chances there.
Right.
And that's what people say about my music. So, having those people in the room, whoever they are, it's just, fantastic.
That's beautiful, man.
So you get, it gets easier. It gets better.
So in terms of the business of what we do, what's your headspace like in terms of that? Do you feel hopeful about the future? Do you feel like, what are some of the challenges that you see us facing as a community or as an industry?
I wonder, in the pre-internet era, you wrote a piece of music and that was it. It got placed and then it never, that was the end of it. This endless accrual, it's accruing of library music.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it like Venice, like the water is just rising and rising and rising and rising. There's so much stuff.
Yeah.
Like there's a foreseeable endpoint where it's a million monkeys, in a room. I've written the works of Shakespeare.
Right.
There's so much library music that there is a way of temping or using library music to score a film. People are doing it. Martin Scorsese has been doing it forever. And, every commercial now, and they just, There's, and the library music is good. It used to be garbage, but now it's top notch. I wonder about that far off future where AI can just like pluck the perfect thing from the database of 20 billion library tracks and just score your film for you based on a film you input.
I think that, you know, the way you've approached both your creative output and the way you work with your collaborators is a shining beacon of hope in that context, because in the end, we're all humans telling each other human stories. And if we're no longer interested in sitting in a room with someone or even having any kind of surprise or having a sense of fun and discovery and, you know, a journey or a story that is a story. I mean, every time when you're working with someone or doing something, it is about a story that you're creating together about how you made this thing. If we're not making things with other people and we're just like hooked into a computer, like, you know, the Matrix, God forbid.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think people want to live like that. So I do think, you know, there's certainly going to be an adjustment where I think a lot of low budget stuff is going to be made that way. But I think that it's not as much about bespoke. It's about that collaboration. It's about that deeply human reason why we're making stuff. And so I think your example of how you work and how you've worked with your collaborators is a beautiful one. Because I think that's the way forward. I think that's, I would encourage other people to sort of like find out what your weird is, turn it up to 11 and find the people that want that from you, because that's what you've done so beautifully.
Well, I often think of the work itself, the show, the record, the music, whatever, as a byproduct. Mm-hmm. It's like data exhaust. And really what the pursuit is the pursuit of us as humans and as family to pursue this creative experience together. Because let's say I did a show or you do a movie, let's say the movie never gets released. The experience you have creatively making it is profound. It's the reason we get up in the morning is to actually do it. So people will continue to pursue that experience for sure.
And I think that's palpable for the audience. I think people can sense that when there was, even if you're making a dark show about dark things, if there's a sense of joy about it, you know, even from the, you know, you just like had a great time collaborating with your partner to make this grimy sounding track that just like expresses that darkness so well. That's palpable. Then something was just like thrown off, didn't care. No one really wanted it.
There's no, no one was fighting, you know, in the making of that piece. So there was no one getting on their knee to like beg to keep that cue in or all of that kind of frisson that happens when you're in the, you know, the development process. Yeah, I believe you can feel that. And you see it in paintings. You know, you look at an old, you know, Willem de Kooning painting or something, and it's like the brush strokes are mad. That guy's angry, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you can just feel it by looking at it. And that really translates through compared to illustration or, you know, anyway, that's just an example. But, you know, all of this golden age of television stuff that we're all, you know, singing its praises, the stuff that's really blown up is every single time, House of Cards or whatever it is, it's where the studio execs said, make your weird art and we'll support it because it's just, there's so much demand. Like, who cares if this doesn't fly?
Right.
Because, you know, you can, and every one of those shows, you know, and the weirder ones are really finding their audience for people like myself who actually don't watch television at all. So the weirder and crazier it is, that's the stuff I'm going to gravitate toward. Like, strangely, I don't watch television, even though I work in it. I don't watch.
You don't eat your own sausages, eh?
I don't. I don't. It's just. I don't know. I've never watched much television, really, and still don't. I love working in it. I think that's. I think I have this fantasy that's. There's some purity in that. In that I'm, because I'm not sort of immersed in the culture so much, I'm drawing my references from other art forms typically, you know, a lot of documentary and whatever literature and, you know, weird music and stuff. But all the time in meetings, they'll go, you know, Tom, have you seen like such and such, or, you know, this thing, or, you know, that show. And it's like, it'll be Game of Thrones or something, you know, it's like, oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely amazing. Game of Thrones. I have no effing clue about, I've never seen Game of Thrones. I've seen like half of one episode.
Wow.
I'll get there. But, I usually have to bone up after those meetings. I pretend I've seen them.
I'm the same way. That's really funny. So what are you working on now that's exciting, and, any personal projects or other things that are gearing up that you're excited about?
Yeah, I'm not one to kind of, I don't relax easily. I mean, I have during this pandemic. It's all been sort of self-care mode, and I've been losing weight and getting in shape, and it's sort of like spa day every day. Mm-hmm. I'm really, Coroner's coming up, you know, thank goodness for season 3. I get excited. Just, it's like first day of school for me, you know, awesome. It's like knowing that this is coming. So I'm in conceptual mode. I'm recording a bunch of stuff that I don't know how it will be used yet, but you know, it's getting onto the hard drive. I've got this sort of, you know, earthquake transducer mic that I got. So I've been going out on my bike and recording the earth. It's pretty wacky. I don't know how it's, you know, it's all low frequencies. I don't know where it's going to fit into the score, but I'm just doing that. I'm in asset acquisition mode, which for me is going out with a field recorder and recording every crazy thing. And I'm feeling emboldened, you know, as I was talking about these guys before, they want the weird stuff. So they're going to get the earthquake microphone. So it's going to record the skunks and whatever.
I love it.
You know, when I was working on a friend, Tamara Williamson's record, I did a little bit of that stuff. She's an amazing singer-songwriter that I've known for 20 years. And she got busy during pandemic and like whipped out a record. It was sort of extraordinary, very motivating.
Wow.
To see somebody like, just like, okay, I'm going to make a thing. Because I kind of was like, I needed a break. I just went into lazy person mode. So, you know, Coroner's coming up. And then I have increasingly sort of robust teaching schedule, which is one of the loves of my life. I've had the good fortune to go back to OCAD. And I've sort of been teaching there off and on since 96, basically. So it's been a long relationship. And so we're teaching remotely this year. You know, it's all going to be over Zoom. I have no idea how I'm going to do that yet. Because I really enjoy the performative aspect of it.
Sure.
It's fun. Yeah. And they like it, and I like it. And it's a big song and dance. And it's like me, you know, talking about music with, you know, my producers. It's like I dance around, and it's a great time.
Where can people find out more about you and follow you online if you do that social media thing at all?
I have a website, www.tomthird.com. I haven't updated it for a year. And I've done
some good stuff on there. I encourage everyone to check it out because you have lots of videos of process stuff and some of the more art films and even some of your visual art is up there as well, right?
Yep. I should have updated it sometime during the pandemic, and it's on my to-do list. It keeps getting subverted by other things, but it's like I haven't talked about Coroner or Dead Still or all these other things I've been working on. And then that's me online. It's also
you're keeping it lean. That's
it's
keeping the mystery alive. Who is Tom Third?
I've never social media. I love it, but it also makes me sad, like everybody else. Yeah. And I've never been comfortable with the kind of proselytizing that kind of goes along with it. I've acclimatized to talking about myself. I think we all have, but it still feels a bit odd.
Yeah.
I'm happier sometimes when I'm not on it. But find me. I friend everybody that friends me. So
there you go. You friend everyone. That's awesome. Well, Tom, this has been absolutely a delight. And thanks you so much for joining me today. Great to hear about all your work and your really inspiring, ways that you're moving through life and creativity. It's been a total joy.
Thanks kindly. Likewise, really fun.
Okay.
Terrifying, but fun.
All right. Have a great rest of your day, man.
Thanks. You too.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider showing your support by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. The Screen Composer Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Graphics and post-production assistance by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as Charlie Finley, Elizabeth Hannon, and Gagan Singh for their support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers, or reach out at tscs@screencomposers.ca.